All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 43 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are now going to talk about another of the important city-states of Greece. We've gotten to the end of the story of the rise of Athenian democracy, rather. It's not really the end of the story of democracy, but rather it is the end of the story of archaic Athenian government and the birth of democracy. So I hope the writing assignment is going well for you. If you haven't turned it in yet, just get it in as soon as you can. I put in a couple days worth of buffer in there in order to allow people to get their writing assignments in late if they need to, so that we can discuss them on Thursday, our final class of this calendar year. So please do your best to get them in to me today if you can. And if you need the extra day, take it. But, you know, do your best in that regard. And so we've gotten to that point in the story of Athens. And, of course, the next thing to do in that, along those lines, is to look at what Athenian democracy did, how it evolved, how the Athenians, running their affairs by means of a democracy, what was life like? Did it solve the problems that they had? And what were the other aspects of their experience with that form of government? Since they innovated it, they created it, they invented it, and were the first people to try it, what did they find out? Right? What was it like to do that? And certainly we will address that theme as we proceed, but we have to do it in the context of the next chapter of history in which the Athenian democracy was embroiled. It is a wider theme. It is a wider chapter in history. So I think it's quite a sad thing, but it is nonetheless what it is, as people say, that the next chapter of the history of Athens was a war. Now, I say that it's a sad thing because a war, nowadays, people don't know what war is. It's one of the most interesting aspects. Well, let me correct what I just said. Nowadays, Americans don't know what war is. They don't know what war is anymore. Because Americans are insulated from war by a variety of factors. It's very, very fascinating. One of the most powerful insulators against war today is the level of technology that American society has and the American military makes use of. And so if you think about it, if the United States, you know, identifies that there is some terrorist in the mountains of Pakistan, well, what happens? Well, the United States military launches a remote vehicle, so-called drone, that has some munitions on board, that's operated by somebody perhaps 1,000 miles away, sitting in a video game console, and he will operate that device remotely, which will fly to the location and drop the bombs on that guy. And then he goes and flies the aircraft back. Well, think about that for a minute. That's to the people that are being bombed, that's war. But what is it to the guy who's fighting on the American side? What is it to that guy sitting in that video game console, Theo?
It's like a video game.
It is like a video game. There's no reality to that. It's abstract. It's indirect. He's not there to see the carnage. The blood of his victims does not spray on his face. Right? And so there's this disconnect between this character and the people that he is killing on behalf of his government. And that disconnect is heightened in terms of the people then who are a part of the society. They don't understand that type of war any better because they are even more disconnected from the reality of the violence. Until such time as somebody puts on some body armor and gets some assault rifles and goes and kills some Americans in California. And then all of a sudden, whoa, bang, the reality of the war is back. There's blood in front of you. There's people dying. And, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, there is a war. But it's a confusing one. It's strange. It doesn't work like a... So, see, my point here is that nowadays, we are in a new kind of phase of history that reflects the rise of how much technology we have and the way that governments act in relation to that and the way that it affects people is very different. If the United States goes and invades a country like Iraq, the truth of the matter is, which is what happened most recently, right? The truth of the matter is most Americans have no idea that's going on. They live their lives without any direct knowledge of that. Now, the truth, only about 1,000 or so families have their sons come home in caskets with the American flag over top, and they live the tragedy of war. But the rest of Americans don't. It's not real to them. And consequently, they don't know how to think about that because they have this unreal experience. They don't know how to process it. They don't know how to think about it clearly because basically they're so insulated from the phenomenon that it doesn't really exist. And this is a really serious issue in terms of how the society operates. And so you get very strange arguments in modern American society pertaining to political violence, pertaining to war, pertaining to these themes, because it's a whole new playing field. It's a whole different type of battlefield, and it's difficult to adjust to. It's difficult to think clearly about that. But I think over time, we will end up having clearer thoughts about this, and it's going to be, it's sad, but basically, it's going to be very interesting because Americans will learn what it means to be Israel. They will learn in their own neighborhoods. They will learn in their own cities what life is like for Israel, because Israel has been living in this state of existence ever since it was born. And it is this new type of war. And I think Americans will become much more empathetic of the little state of Israel when they have more and more of the types of experiences that they're going to have. War will become real to them, and it will become much more of a serious question. And we'll see how that goes. But anyway, it's just, to me, this is fascinating because, of course, most people think of America as a democracy, and there's going to be some voting next year, and then we have the theme of war. And when I look at Athens, I look back and I see so many instructive parallels. I see a society that became a democracy, and then the very next thing that happened was a war. But this was a real war. I mean, what the word really, the reason why people came up with a word, right? Because there was a reality that needed to be named. So when the Athenians went to war, their entire society was convulsed. There was no insulation from the phenomenon. You could not sit in your living room during the war and think otherwise and have the luxury of, you know, talking about war like it's a video game, and it's not real, and just kind of the way that people conduct themselves today, in a way, have the luxury of conducting themselves today that didn't exist back then. So when Athens went to war, it was extremely disruptive, and of course that means that the story of democracy is very confused, because war is an emergency. Countries go to war when their existence is threatened, when the citizens of the country cannot expect that their right to life will be ensured unless the state collectively murders people from some other part of the world to prevent them from doing that to the people of the country. And so it is barbarism. It is, in the famous words of an American general, war is hell. And it is a really sad feature of human existence. But it is, historically speaking, necessary. There's no way around it for various reasons. And it is such an important phenomenon. So it's when we get into this war that Athens is going to be in, we're going to see it's going to have huge effects on the democracy, and ultimately it's going to destroy the democracy. And that's one thing that people are afraid of today, is that war and democracy are incompatible fundamentally. I don't think that's true, but anyway, it's not my most important question. For me, I will say that war and rights are incompatible, and in a very fundamental sort of way. The Founding Fathers understood that too. And thus, a country that is permanently at war is not a country that can protect and defend rights. And so I think we do see that a lot in modern America. But anyway, this is me getting excited about this theme. I'm sorry, sometimes I say perhaps too much, but sometimes I let myself do that because I want you to understand that, you know, maybe give you a new slant on some of the stories that you see around you. And hopefully that's a spur to your own thinking, because these are what we call historians, at least I, as a historian, and there used to be more historians used to talk about this. These are what we call universal themes. A universal theme is a question that pertains to human life as such. It doesn't pertain to Athens 508 BC only. It doesn't pertain to United States 2015 AD only. It doesn't pertain to France 1789 AD only. It doesn't pertain to China 551 BC only. Or it doesn't, right? It applies in all of those places equally. That is something that history reveals and helps us to appreciate and understand. And that's part of the value of it, is that we learn to detect and think about universal truths pertaining to human life. So this is the story of Athens, and now we're going to talk about this place called Sparta. It's chock full of these themes. It is bursting with these instructional themes. And one of them is the challenge of rights and in the context of war. And so we're going to get to that. But the war in question, which I already teased you that it was coming, the war in question does not merely involve Athens. The war in question is known as the Greco-Persian Wars. So we know one side of that is Persia, but the Greco part, the second part there, in the term, in fact, the first part, right, doesn't refer to Athens, it refers to Greece together, the whole thing. Now, but we know that Greece was not together. What was it? It wasn't a unified country. King?
It was made up of independent small city-states.
Right, okay. It was a collection of city-states, which means cities behaving like what? I know you're tempted to use the word state. Use a different word. Like, a state is too vague of a term. Julia?
Countries.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Okay, so cities behaving like countries. Well, cities in effect being countries where a territory that would amount to approximately a modern-day county, you know, would be, or a metropolitan area perhaps would be another term for that, would be about the size of it. And it's a country. It's a country with its own independent government and its own army, a citizen army. So when we talk about the Greco-Persian Wars, we're talking about all of Greece fighting. Not in some way or another, not entirely always on the same side. But most of Greece fighting on one side against the Persians on the other. And so evidently, it's not good enough to just talk about Athens. Or it would be misleading or really insufficient, especially given what you see on your screen right now. If we're talking about all these locations that are labeled here, these are important places, then how could we talk about the Greco-Persian Wars in relation to Athens alone? That wouldn't make sense. So that's why we're going to talk now about Sparta, because Athens was the most important city in Greek history. No question about it. It is far and away the most important. But a distant second, but nonetheless second and way ahead of anybody else as well, was Sparta. So when we speak of the Greco-Persian Wars and we speak of Greece as being united, we are speaking about a temporary unity under the combined leadership of Athens and Sparta. Those two. So, of course, we've got to make some account of Sparta. What was this place? What was this unique, this other city-state that obviously had a very distinctive, crucial role, a pivotal role in a series of events that is hugely important? Right? So we got Athens, and we have Sparta, and these are the two most important city-states. So now we need to talk about Sparta. So we know, with that lead in, we know that Sparta was very important to the Greco-Persian Wars. Let me tell you what the second thing that was crucially important about Sparta is, that it was an example of, well, it was in fact the only example of, and thus really the innovator in this regard as well, of yet another form of government. So that would make, in effect, the fifth form of government that we are going to encounter in ancient Greece. Theo, I don't want you to guess what it is. So, now, in order to discuss this form of government, we're going to engage in a process that is very similar to our process of art appreciation. That's why I didn't want Theo to spoil it for us in case I don't know if you're going to get the right answer or not, Theo, but because there are a variety of interesting answers that could be proposed, I think ultimately one is better than all the others. And that's going to be a part of our purpose in exploring this topic, is to figure out what that best answer is. But in order to get that best answer, we need to look at Sparta in the same way that we look at a painting, in order to get the best title for the painting. It's exactly the same process. We need to begin by looking. And we need our looking to be comprehensive. We can't just look at one part of the painting and name the painting after that. We can't just look at two of the parts of the painting and combine those and give the painting a title and ignore all the rest. When we look at a painting, we have to be comprehensive in our description. And only in that fullness, in that context that is complete, can we arrive at the best title. And the same thing goes for naming the government of Sparta as a new form of government. If you look at one part of it, you'll say, oh, it's a... dot, dot, dot. You look at another part of it, you'll say, oh, it's a... no, it's this other thing. Dot, dot, dot. You put them together and you might say, ah, this is what it is. And we'll come up with a new word. And you'd still be wrong. Because there's 10 other things to look at. And you didn't look at them. And consequently, your description and your definition are incomplete. So this is a very good exercise in terms of studying the government of Sparta, because it's very similar to the discipline process that we have to undertake in order to understand a work of art. We have to integrate all of the evidence and come up with the best answer. So let me start with a hint. Let me start with a hint concerning the government of Sparta. Wait. I'm getting ahead of myself. I want to do a quick, this should be a lightning quick review of the four concepts we have so far, right? Because these now have to form our context. So a context of learning is the knowledge that you already have so that you're ready to learn something else. Okay, so if we don't have the four forms of government as a context, then every time we learn another one, well, it becomes like trying to juggle balls. If you don't know how to juggle four balls, what happens if you're working on that and I give you another one? Right? Get the picture? You're struggling so hard to juggle the four, and then I say, here's another one. Do five. Well, what happens? Obviously, the whole thing breaks down on you. So, again, if we're going to go, we're going to say, oh, here's a fifth form of government. You drop them all, Theo. That's the right answer. That's the problem, right? So if I give you a fifth form of government, and you don't have the other four already automatized as a context, then those four are going to get all jumbled up with the fifth one. You're going to drop all of them. Right? So that's why I want to confirm here that we have the four as a context now. If we do, then we're ready to move on. So let's see here. I want everybody's hand up. Everybody's hand down right now. But I want everybody's hand up on any question that they know the answer to here. And let's do it as fast as we can. Okay? So the first form of government, I want you to give me the most essentialized definition on each of these. Ready? Number one, monarchy. Okay, Timothy.
The rule of one.
The rule of one. Okay, good. Mon means one, archy, the rule of. Okay, hands down, the rule of one. Typically a king, right? Okay, second form of government, aristocracy. Okay, Abby.
The rule of the aristocrats.
Which means?
The best.
Okay, those who call themselves the best. Okay, a large group of people, which in Athens would be, the example would be, Abby?
The Medonti.
They are the family of the dynasty that rules the monarchy.
So the Eupatrids.
The Eupatrids. Okay, good. Aristocracy, the rule of the best. A large ruling class. Still a minority, though. Okay, third form of government, the rule of a tyrannos. Interesting, distinctive form. I only see two hands going up. That is not a good sign. Why are not all the hands going up? Rosie, what is the rule of a tyrannos? I'm getting no answer here. Okay, so, Rosie, this is a big one for you, because it's not a context. I have now given you another ball to juggle, and you can't take it. You will not be able to work with this one. So, you have more work to do, if it's not automatic. Okay, so, Nemo, what is the rule of a Tyrannos?
I'm not sure, but I think maybe it means that it's a single person. Unlike modern day, which means tyrant, I think it's maybe a single person that does good for the people, that rules, maybe.
Whether he does good or not is not essential to the concept of tyrannos. But, so, I'm glad that we are getting this one. This needs to be pinned down. Keen, the essence is what?
A ruler put into place by the popular support of the people.
Okay, right. The people, a ruler chosen by the people. That is a tyrannos. So, the key here is that the rule of a tyrannos is, in fact, a form of monarchy. But it is distinctive. It is distinctive because the monarchy is not hereditary. Okay? It is popular. You could call it popular monarchy if you need a quick... two-word definition, type of definition. Go with that. Popular monarchy. A king chosen by the people. And this was important because in traditional societies, in archaic societies, the king was always a member of the aristocracy, specifically of the most prestigious family. In the case of Athens, the Medontidae. But if you had a tyrannos, okay, it's a king chosen by the people, by the commoners. Now, Nemo, the point about whether or not he does good or not, of course, we don't know if he does good. He's popular, but popular doesn't mean good, right? So, just look at modern politics. So, that should be enough of an example. All right, so there we go. So, we have the rule of a tyrannos. Okay, let's hope that this fourth one is pretty easy to juggle here. So, let's go with democracy. Okay, Theo.
The rule of many.
No, it's not many. No.
Sorry, the rule of the majority.
Okay, but democracy means? Demos.
The people.
Okay, good. And that always does, because things are voted upon, okay, fundamentally resolve itself as the rule of the majority. Okay, so we need those both, right? Because demos means people. So the rule of the people, okay, ultimately, which means the majority. All right, so that was a little shakier than I was hoping, but it is, I think for some of you, it's pretty solid. For others, perhaps not. So you need to decide for yourself what is the strength of that context, because if I give you yet another ball to juggle, are you going to drop it or not? Okay, so you think about it and ask me tomorrow if there's a question, a follow-up on that. So for the moment, Abby, put your hand down. Okay, so the Spartans, here's a hint about the Spartan government. We remember the story of Sparta. Already we have one small story about it because the Spartans restored the aristocracy of Athens. Remember that the nobility of Athens bribed the oracle at Delphi, and thus the Spartan army assisted them in restoring aristocracy. That's an interesting hint. What would that suggest about the Spartans? That's too easy. Juliet.
They have a very strong military force.
Well, yeah, okay, but I'm not talking about how powerful they were. I'm talking about what kind of government do they have. Right? If the United States goes to Iraq and gives the people a democracy, well, why would it do that? Well, because it thinks of itself as standing for democracy, and thus its foreign policy is pro-democracy. Okay, get my point, Juliet?
To it, they had a monarchy because they had a king.
Well, oh, now you got too clever there, because I didn't ask it in that way, but you got ahead of me. Because if they restored the Athenian aristocracy, then I guess it seems pretty straightforward to me that you would expect them to have a sympathy with aristocracy, right? Because that's what they helped Athens to get. But meanwhile, as you point out, because you remembered so clearly, it was the king of Sparta that went to Delphi to talk with the oracle, so to get its revelations, what have you. So, yes, there was a king going to the oracle, so doesn't that suggest monarchy? At least what it suggests in this combined story is that there were elements of these things present. Right? Let's put it that way. Because I should have given you already enough of a really blatant set of hints here that it's not going to be the usual thing. But my whole point is to tease you a little bit here and to keep you thinking that, okay, there's some evidence one way or another. Let's talk about, in particular, the aristocratic element, because that is very strong. So, a little bit of history for Sparta. If you remember, the aristocracy in Athens had obtained its position as the sons of noble fathers because the Eupatrids had defended the city. They were the ones responsible for maintaining Athens' independence in the context of the Dorian invasion. This strange wave of disruptions involving a tribe called the Dorians. The Athenians were not Dorians. They had survived that onslaught. They had maintained their independence. They were members of the tribe known as the Ionians. But the Spartans were Dorians. They had successfully conquered, in that very same chapter, which is prehistorical, really, because we don't have the record of what happened. We only have the record of the outcome. But in that same prehistorical chapter, the Spartans came to be in control of their own city-state by conquest. So notice the difference. Athens emerges into history by deflecting the conquest, but Sparta emerges into history after the conquest, in a place where the conquest was successful, where the aristocracy is Dorian. So that's going to lead to a different dynamic in the society, right? Think about the difference for a second here. What do you expect is going to be different? In a society like Athens, the people of the different classes are all of the same tribe. In a place like Sparta, the aristocracy is of a different tribe. Theo.
Well, so, I mean, my first thought was actually Sparta might be more oriented towards war and fighting because that's how their country started out. And then the other is that there will be a pretty different class difference because, you know, these people are in charge because they conquered the lower classes.
Yes. Okay. So that's the crucial difference, is that the class distinctions are not just a reflection of the history of the city-state, but that history specifically involves one tribe dominating another. So in modern comparisons, it would be more like one country conquering another, or colonizing another. So it would be like the British Empire in India, right? Where the British are the rulers and the entire native population is subordinate, right? Think of it in those terms. Most of Africa was in that situation as well. Britain, Germany, France, Portugal, a bunch of different countries, all conquered various parts of Africa. And so they had their colonial empires there. And the Europeans ruled. and the native population was subordinate. So same idea here. So, but not quite as acute, I guess, a difference in the sense that these are tribes of the same people in some sense, right? If we go wider than the concept tribe, we end up either at the concept nation or the concept race. And so these people belong to, pick whichever one you want, the same nation or the same race. Probably nation in this sense would be the best term because it's the Greeks. So they're all Greeks, but it would be, this is an interesting one to try to make more modern, to give you some sensibility of it. It would be as though, you know, the British, I mean, this is the opposite of what happened in history, but the British conquered the United States, right? Or let's reverse it and let's say the United States conquers Britain. Let's have some fun with it. So the United States turns around and conquers Britain. Well, that would be, right, the same people in a sense, the members of the same, not even nation or race, but, right, English-speaking people, very much of the same descent, same national background, right? So if one of those ruled the other, you would expect the relationship to have a certain character, as opposed to if the United States conquered France. That would be very different, right? Because the language is different, the culture is different, the relationship between the people would be different. So here in Sparta, we have different tribes of the same people. But anyway, it's still a conquest relationship. So the Spartan lords in this relationship, well, we're going to use the terms that they themselves used just to differentiate a little bit between what we see in Sparta and what we see elsewhere. So the aristocracy, or the aristocrats rather, were called the Spartiatai. Very much like the word Spartan, of course. Kind of a Greek-sounding sort of a term. And the commoners, who were Ionians and whatever other variety, right, were beneath them, were known as the Periakoi. So this is going to be like a few extra balls to juggle if you are not comfortable with terms like aristocrat and commoner. But hopefully, in this situation, you'll be able to take, in the context of Sparta, you'll be able to take these names and connect them to each other and it'll make sense for you. And then at the very bottom of the society, we have the slaves, who are referred to in Sparta as the helots. So I'm going to use those terms in this context because we use the term aristocrat, but in Athens we're talking about the eupatrids. In Sparta we're talking about the Spartiatai, right? So they are different people, members of different tribes, so it's worth differentiating them. And in Sparta as well, the Periakoi and the helots have a unique status, and it's worth, well, setting them apart as well from other types of commoners and trying to kind of characterize them or categorize them in their unique role that they're playing. A good example of that uniqueness is that in Sparta, the Periakoi and the helots could be put to death at will by the Spartiatai. So this was part of the society. This was part of the set of laws. This was part of the norms of the society. A Spartiate individually, okay? If he didn't like the way one of the commoners looked at him sideways, he could cut his head off and that'd be the end of it. He didn't have to justify himself. He didn't have to refer to the Sixth Amendment of the Spartan Constitution. He didn't have to say, well, this guy broke that law. No, he could just kill him. The Spartans had absolute power over the Periakoi and the Helots. Or to put it in more kind of American terms, the Periakoi, the commoners, as well as the slaves, had no right to life. That would be a modern expression, right? But that is the most clarifying, useful expression, right? So it's worth making use of. In other societies, slaves typically don't have a right to life. That is not unique, right? That's not special. It happens everywhere, sadly. Slaves don't have a right to their own life. But that's the concept. That's where it comes from. That's why we have the word slave. But in the commoners of Sparta, the Periakoi, were in the same position. They didn't have a right to their own life. In other words, you're walking down the street, you get out of the way of the Spartan, because if he is in a bad mood, you're dead. And that's it. You know, there's no recourse. There's no, your parents can't sue him. You know, your brothers and sisters can't do anything about it. It's over. You have no rights. Even though you're one of the commoners. But that's part of the society. And here's another one. The slaves of this society, the Helots, were not owned by individual Spartans. They were not owned by individual members of the aristocracy. They were owned, and now here comes a very important vocabulary word, so I'm going to chat it. The slaves in this society were owned collectively. Which means what? Big term, complicated term, very important term. Theo, what's your guess?
Well, it would be owned by more than one people. So maybe they're owned by the government or by the aristocracy.
Okay, so you're kind of feeling your way around this one, trying to tell me what the shape of it is, which is good. Okay, good guesses, good ideas. Anybody else? Okay, to understand this concept of collective ownership, there are some interesting examples of the implementation of such an idea in modern society as well. So the best one, I think, that would be amenable for you guys would be the example of roads today. So think about how the roads work. Right? When you leave the garage or the parking spot or the driveway of your home or apartment or whatever, you take the car onto a road. Now, if it's your home, you own that garage or you own that driveway, that's yours. Okay, but the road, what about the road? Who owns that? Theo?
Well, the government.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the state owns it, and so they maintain it, and then you pay them taxes, and then they use those taxes to pay people to refurbish the roads.
All right, so those are certainly aspects of how it works. Let's talk about some more aspects here so that we can get some clarity on this idea, right? When we talk about your home, when we talk about your car, and right now I want everybody to imagine and summon in their own minds their most prized personal possession. Think about what that thing is. Your thing that belongs to you, that is your most prized personal possession. Anybody care to share? Anybody give me an example to work with here? My most prized personal possession, material possession, would be my computer. I can't do anything without my computer. Abby?
My most prized personal possession might be, and this might sound really kind of silly, but I think it might be my knitting needles, because I love to knit.
Okay, no, nothing silly about that at all, right? I mean, that is about who you are. That is something that you really treasure. It's an activity that is so important to you, right? That's exactly what I'm looking for, that personal association there, okay? It's yours, right? Okay, and so this is normally when we say, when we talk about ownership, we're talking about that exclusive right to something. That it belongs to you, not anybody else, and you don't share it, and you don't, it's not kind of yours sometimes, and somebody else's another time, and it's not like you, the whole concept here is exclusivity, right? Whereas on the road, you don't have that, right? You can drive down the road, but so can everybody else. Right, so that's part of the way that collective ownership works, is that this use and control of this whatever thing it is, material possession or resource, is exercised in common. Collectively is another way to put it. Okay, so let's not focus on Nemo's spider because that's very distracting. And so let's keep focusing on the roads here. So this is part of the idea of the collective ownership, but I wanted to make sure that we talk about that a little bit before we hone in on Theo's point, which is valid and useful, but we should think about it in terms of this exclusive use and control of, right? Because you have exclusive use of your home. Nobody else can go in there. That is against the law, unless you invite them in, they're guests, right? If somebody attacks your home, you have the right to defend your life and property, including in the most extreme cases, to kill that person in self-defense. And so that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the exclusive use and control and ownership of something. So does anybody have such ownership, exclusive use and control over the roads? Well, Theo's answer is no, but in a way, you are contradicting yourself, because is it possible for somebody to shut down a road and say nobody gets to use this? Just like you get to close your home? Right? Nemo, you're distracted. Is it possible for somebody to shut down a road and say nobody gets to use this road? Rosie says yes. Go ahead, Rosie.
They can shut it down if it needs repairs and stuff, but they have to get approved by certain people.
Yeah, the only people who could shut down the road would be the police or the army. And yes, certainly they'd have to be authorized in some sense by the government, right? This is what Theo's point was, to some extent, was that the ownership of such things that we think of as public, really, in every practical sense, is exercised through government. So collective ownership is ownership through government. The government ultimately controls it. It's the government that has access to immediate use of force in defense of, in control of, that particular material resource. And nobody else can compete with the government over that issue. So if the government says this road is closed, well, the road's closed. That's ownership, right? That's what I mean in terms of, if you want to think about this concept a little bit more clearly, that will help. So the Spartans had collective ownership of slaves. Which means what? Who controlled and regulated the use of slaves in Sparta? Individual households? This is my slave, this is your slave, Julia?
The government.
The government. Okay. Crucial point. Crucial point. Okay. Good. So, this is different, right? I mean, in Athens, if an aristocrat had a slave, it was his personal property. In Sparta, slaves belonged to the state. That's kind of the modern way of expressing it, which in this context means the government. It's a collective ownership. It is a contradiction. It is an inevitable, it is a walking, talking contradiction, collective ownership. But the way that it's resolved, it's not resolved, but it is the way that people try to handle this contradiction is by juggling this idea that, well, the government does it, but then, well, then the people vote and they control the government, and then you kind of have to juggle it all the time. It's a constant juggling process. That's how people think of so-called public property or collective. I mean, they don't use terms like collective ownership, but they will speak of public properties like public parks and national parks and things like that, which belong to nobody and everybody. And of course, the government controls them. And then, well, in some sense, the people control it because the people control the government, but. And then you go back and forth in that. And it just is a never-ending kind of logical puzzle because fundamentally what you're doing is collective ownership is a negation of the essence of ownership, which is exclusive use and control. So that's why I was trying to point out to you guys that the your most prized personal possession, which is yours and nobody else's, that's property. That's yours. That's ownership. And your home, which nobody else can invade, that's property. That's ownership. Including the police, right? They can't enter your home without a warrant unless you let them in. And if they do, in the most extreme cases, it's even legal for you to shoot them. So it's that. I mean, that's remarkable, right? That's ownership, where the government doesn't have access to it at all. It's yours. That's exclusive right to property. So collective ownership that you can't you can't resolve that. It does not exist. But basically, it. It functions, or people try to make it work by navigating between these various logical contortions, is what they are. And in the end, the government controls it. All right, that is one of the puzzles now of how we're going to figure out, well, what do we name such a thing? What do we name such a thing when the government is owns certain people in the society? What's that called? Even the commoners have no right to life. What kind of society is that? There's part of the puzzle, and let me give you the final part of the puzzle just to get you even more confused, because it's fun. Here's the Spartan twist on monarchy. Sparta did have a king. So we've got that to deal with too. So what was his role? Well, that's not easy to say, because the Spartan twist on monarchy was that Sparta had two kings. So, when we come back tomorrow, I'll see if I can pile on more confusions on top of the ones you already have, but hopefully at least are struggling with. Final thoughts for today? After your first impressions of the Spartan government, are you now, what's your new impression of the Spartan government? You're interested to know more? A very peculiar thing. Theo?
I think I actually remembered that it had two kings. It's called a duarchy, right?
It is indeed. So if you want the name of that, it is duarchy. But that certainly would not be the name of the form of government. That is merely one of the features of this form of government. So, just like in a painting, if we're going to get it right, we're going to have to get all the features together and then say, aha, we need a new term for that. What is it? Okay. We're on our way. Okay, thanks everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Mr. Brown. Thanks for class. Mm-hmm.